The next case is 97-1595, Michael J. Gennaro versus Central Transport, Inc. Mr. Gillis.
Mr. Chief Justice, this is the court. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. Today we're here to ask this court to determine and resolve once and for all whether or not individual supervisors and managers may be held liable under Chapter 41-12. Obviously, the beginning of any such discussion is the literal language of the statute, which we believe is clear on the facts. The statute defines employer for purposes of employment discrimination cases as any employer of 4 or more employees and any person who acts directly or indirectly on behalf of that employer. And the statute says persons includes employees. It is important to note, as has been addressed in the briefs, that the same federal courts relied upon by respondents that have ruled that there's no individual liability in this type of settlement have said that those same words are in other federal statutes, such as the Equal Pay Act, such as the Fair Labor Standards Act, such as the Family Medical Leave Act. They mean supervisors can be sued individually, and that includes federal statutes where there are numerosity requirements, such as the Family Medical Leave Act. But there are other reasons that language is extremely clear, and that the General Assembly sent a clear message that they felt individual discriminators who engage in intentional acts of discrimination should be held accountable. They included an aiding and abetting provision in 41-1202J, which is not present in the federal statute. They included originally, in the original version of 41-1299, a criminal penalty provision, which is no comparable provision ever in Title VII, all indicating that personal accountability was to be included in the statute. What the respondents are really asking this court to say, and I think it's clear and unmistakable, is that when Ohio, which was one of the first states in the country, before the federal government, to address modern discrimination employment problems, when they enacted this statute in 1959 to attack discrimination, they intended to immunize executives and managers who personally engaged in intentional discrimination while making only their employers liable. I submit to you that doesn't make any sense for a couple of reasons. First of all, it is contrary to the common law. Even in 1959, if a security guard working for Provost wrongly suspects a shoplifter and then used excessive force to make them comply with his request, sure, Grover's was liable under vicarious liability principles, but so was the security guard. When a Lazarus department store driver in 1959 drove a load of goods over to their storage facility and had an accident, sure, Lazarus was liable vicariously, but so was the driver. There is no difference under the statute at the time. In fact, what the legislature was doing was creating vicarious liability and personal liability for something that had not been legal at common law. Secondly, the
Counsel, position... could we talk about the words that you started out with, the actual text? And a first reading surely gets us where you're arguing. I'm wondering about the fact in the whole statutory scheme in the definition section, employee is defined and employer is defined in the phrase that we're here about today, that last phrase in the definition of employer. I'm just wondering how you reconcile, and I'm having trouble with an employee being an employer, which is where we come out on your side of the argument. An employee is also an employer because it has to meet the definition of employer to be responsible or liable individually. Wouldn't we, and the words we're using, directly or indirectly, acting directly or indirectly in the interest of the employer, would we not, were we to hold in your favor, would we not be placing every employee in any organization, because I would say we'd have to argue that every employee acts directly or indirectly in the interest of their employer in the scope of employment. So wouldn't we be putting, you know, every person on the assembly line at risk here for being individually liable in damage, to respond in damages for this, in, maybe they weren't even a decision maker. Maybe there's somebody who is charged with sexual harassment, who's made lewd comments to a coworker. Aren't we, I mean, is that our end result, that every employee can be an employer under this statute?
Your Honor, employees who engage in intentional acts of discrimination, yes, any of them would be liable under the statute. Yet they work for an employer, employees for all employees.
Well,
it does not create general liability for everybody who wants to plan. Under the law of discrimination, you must show that there was an animus before you can get liable.
Well, I mean, right. I guess we all agree about that. But the point is, either we have only employers responsible, at least everybody's agreed that there are certain tort remedies against individuals, but under this statute, 4112, we're really talking about whether we should have just employers respond in damages or reinstatement, all the remedies, or every other person who works directly or indirectly or acts indirectly or directly for an employer.
Well, it would not cover everybody who acts indirectly or directly unless they committed an act of discrimination. You have to...
Well, that's same with the employer. That's, I mean, that goes without saying, right? We're talking about discrimination. That goes without saying.
Well, no. Employers, there's vicarious liability here created for organization. That was the original purpose of the statute. And the purpose of the statute was to make illegal employment decisions, such as refusing to hire someone because they're black, or refusing to promote women, or refusing to give promotions, or refusing to give the same vacations to women as men. That was the original purpose of this, because it wasn't that kind
but
of potential conduct.
It's broader than that. It shall be unlawful, be an unlawful discriminatory practice, and then it speaks to any matter directly or indirectly related to employment. It's very broad. I mean, we do have a catch-all even in the liability section.
Well, the definitional section is saying that someone who acts indirectly or directly can be considered an employer for the purposes of the act.
Mm-hmm.
But the acts which are made illegal are not, for example, it's not true that you can sue an individual supervisor at common law for all acts of discrimination. It is true that for sexual harassment, this court has recognized public policy. It is true that the federal government, for 20-some years now, in race discriminations under Section 1981 and Section 1982, has allowed individual supervisors and managers to be sued. But for general discrimination based on sex, as an example, which doesn't involve harassment, there is no common law remedy that you were in course. It's only because of Chapter 4112 that these supervisors and managers can be held responsible for their personal acts.
Is sexual harassment a tort?
Yes.
We have all of this briefing, this much here. Whatever happened to the proposition that we first learned in law school in torts, that every person is liable for his or her own individual torts?
You know, that's exactly the point we're making here. The problem is that many types of discrimination, most types of discrimination, are tools in a common law sense. They're only illegal because of the statute. We submit that it would be absurd to suggest, which is what the respondents are saying, hey, that if you really want to enforce the discrimination laws, make sure we can't be held personally accountable and we'll take care of it. But it doesn't make any sense. What's going to effectively enforce this law? Just holding organizations liable, or holding those who personally commit the acts responsible, where there's sufficient proof? I submit to you, shareholders might have a very different view about whether or not only businesses should be personally accountable for discrimination that occurs by specific acts of supervisors.
Mr. Gittes, would you see your interpretation of the statute applying to an independent contractor?
In some circumstances.
The statute says person, it doesn't say employee. Any person acting directly or indirectly, so could it be an independent contractor?
The statute says individual, the statute says person equals individuals, one or more employees of this under the interest. But it depends on the circumstances, exactly what they're doing. So The reality of the situation here is that the very purpose of the statute was to impose responsibility for something which was totally not covered at all in common law. The parade of horribles that's presented in the recent responses we know is simply not the case. As I indicated, it has been the law for some time now in the counties, it's been the law under federal law for over 20 years that managers are personally responsible for waste and ethics. You haven't seen managers flooding away. You haven't seen an end to the ability to get managers to conduct their business, even though when they commit purposeful acts of discrimination, they're allowed. We also know there's abundant protection in the law. Dr. Heil has one of the strongest sets of statutory rules prohibiting frivolous lawsuits. We have the exercise of summary judgment procedures. We have a parade of protections against abusive litigation, which seems to be the primary concern. Again, we have history to prove that even though the federal law has been there in the race area for years, there hasn't been that kind of a major flood of these kinds of problems.
Mr. Gittes, may I ask one more question about the language of this particular statutes that we're dealing with? In 41-1202G, if we take the proposition, your opponent's proposition is that the language we're dealing with really is to incorporate the concept of respondeat superior. And that's why the General Assembly didn't use more direct language to say any employer is any person, any person it shall be unlawful for any person to discriminate. Instead, it says employer in O2. But in G, it speaks to as another example of what is unlawful, it's unlawful for any proprietor or any employee, keeper, or manager of a place of public accommodation. You're familiar with it. So in one part of that statute, the General Assembly actually used the words manager and employee instead of employer. Does that have any bearing on distinguishing? Why wouldn't that be kind of redundant if an employee, if the definition of employer already includes employer, employee?
We don't have to test the definition of employer includes employees, because it says that. What's the purpose of having a definition if you're going to disregard the definition? The definition says employers include persons who act indirectly, directly, and persons means, there was a list, including employees. You're defeating the whole purpose.
But it doesn't say employees. That's what's interesting. It doesn't say employees, does it? It uses more roundabout language.
No.
That's why we have the debate.
Statute uses the word employee.
It defines employee.
Defines employer to include employees.
Well, it doesn't, not in the definition of employer, though.
It does by using, it says, employee includes employers and persons, and it defines persons to include employees.
Well,
what would be the purpose of having that definition if you didn't use it?
Right.
It would be senseless.
But we have two different definitions, and one doesn't include the other, does spark some debate, doesn't it?
I see under 41-1201A1, the word employee under the definition of person. I don't know if that's what Justice Cook is saying.
Not an employer is my point. It's not, the word employee is not used in the section that we're talking about.
Well, the section that includes the word employer, word by definition includes persons.
Right.
And persons includes employees.
I think you responded this in a brief, but I'd like to hear your response to the argument that if employee becomes an employer for purposes of your argument here, then what happens to respondent superior? They're all employers now.
It doesn't change the situation.
So the company still, the employer, the actual employer, can still be also left.
Sure. It's just like the company. It's always been the case. Vicarious liability means the individual doesn't get out of the responsibility, but because of the concept of vicarious liability, the organization also is accountable. That's the very nature. It doesn't end. Nor does tort reform affect this, because tort reform, if you take a look at section 2307.31b, specifically excludes from this coverage vicarious liability. So contrary to the representations of respondents, suddenly discrimination law is not going to be transformed with percentage decisions or any of that business, because law specifically excludes it. One last comment I'd like to reserve my time is that the numerosity requirement is not an issue in this case. The legislature adopted a numerosity requirement to protect the smallest of businesses, the mom and pop grocery store, that had one or two employees because for the first time the legislature was making them vicariously liable for discrimination, which hadn't even been illegal. That doesn't, so if one clerk in the store abused a black customer, they didn't want to wipe out a small mom-and-pop grocery store because of vicarious liability. It was not intended to say that the manager of the store worked for the mom-and-pop was free to discriminate without any responsibility.
Thank you, Mr. Pettis. Ms. Anderson.
May it please the court, I am counsel for one of the three respondents in your case. Mr. Hubbard represents the other two. I'm going to take about 7 minutes if I can, and then Mr. Hubbard will take the balance of the time. My focus will be on the appropriate statutory interpretation of the Ohio Civil Rights Act, but I do have an overview. This is not a David versus Goliath case, it is a David versus David case. It is not a labor versus management case, it is in fact a worker versus worker case. And you are correct, Justice Cook, that if you, by your question, that if you say yes to the certified question here, then you are exposing every individual employee on the assembly line to possible personal liability, and not just personal liability, but personally to have to defend himself or herself in a lawsuit in which the employer may or may not provide a defense.
Don't you think that was the intention of the legislature in enacting this? To have accountability on the part of every employer who is working indirectly or directly on behalf of the employer.
The employer, Your Honor, is the entity on the hook. There's no doubt about that. No dispute here. The employer is the one that is responsible for seeing that there is not discrimination in the workplace. And that is why the language of the statute imposes responding at superior by this language, not individual personal responsibility for the people on the assembly line. And let me explain about the statutory interpretation that you should look at. First of all, this language was enacted in 1959, 5 years before the federal government enacted the Title VII law. The definition of employer in both Title VII and in the Ohio Civil Rights Act was designed for responding at superior. Make sure the employer does not get off the hook, Your Honor, by saying, well, we didn't authorize John Doe to harass the woman next to him on the assembly line, so therefore we, the employer, are responsible.
But
both the federal government and the Ohio General Assembly said you can't do that.
But aren't you encouraging sexual harassment if the individual employee knows he cannot be sued?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. Absolutely not, because the way that both the Title VII and Ohio Civil Rights Act are designed is to encourage the employer to root out the bad guy. And the Walton case, if you look at the Walton case out of the Sixth Circuit, you will see exactly how the anti-discrimination laws work best. In that case, the Sixth Circuit held that both Title VII and the Kentucky Civil Rights Act do not impose individual liability for the guy on the assembly line.
That's been proven to cut down on sexual harassment?
Let's look at what happened in that case, Your Honor.
No, try and answer my question.
I am.
Has that shown that sexual harassment in the workplace has decreased because the individual worker is not liable?
The individual worker, as Justice Douglas has pointed out, is individually liable for their own torts.
So you want to answer my question?
Your Honor, I don't know of any empirical data on the effect on sexual harassment claims. I do know from the case law, and that's what we've researched, that in the Walton case, for example, the employer terminated one individual defendant, gave a written reprimand against another individual defendant, issued public apologies to the plaintiff, and instituted a policy in its workplace against sexual harassment.
Only one of the people allegedly responsible was fired. The others.
One was fired, and the others
were reprimanded.
Your Honor, it's under the facts of that case that may have been the way to go.
I see.
And that the structure of this act, the structure of Title VII, does encourage employers to enforce anti-discrimination policies.
Why would employers not want their employees who have caused the problem to be individually responsible? I know what I read in your brief that it'll affect settlement or it'll put pressure on and so on. But why would you not want the perpetrator to be responsible? And if, in fact, that's such a big thing to you, all the employer has to do is indemnify them. the employee.
Your Honor, you're making the assumption that everyone who is sued is, in fact, guilty, and that's not the case. If you look at the case law, look at the Jenkins case out of California. Plaintiffs hypothesize a supervisor already known to be guilty of discrimination and ask why he or she should not be personally liable. However, the conundrum is that life is not lived retrospectively, but rather prospectively. Individual supervisors must be able to make well-considered personnel decisions before knowing what claims an employer may later advance. And if you also look at the different Ohio cases, both federal and state, where these kinds of claims have been brought, you will see that more often than not, the claims are dismissed as a matter of law. The courts will say there is not one iota of evidence of racial discrimination here. There is no claim of sexual discrimination here. Yet, when you assume only that the guilty are sued, perhaps it looks like an attractive argument. But very often, the innocent are sued. And the innocent worker who makes $20,000 a year should not be on the line when there's no requirement that the employer identify them. There's no insurance against this. The right public policy decision is that the employer, which has the burden of enforcing the anti-discrimination laws, and which has the wherewithal to pay and be on the hook if there is something to the claim, that's where the onus should be.
It's funny, I thought all this business about tort reform and all was that we're trying to get away from lawyers suing deep pockets. Now all of a sudden we're going to... Employers are here saying, oh, we want to protect an employee against the discrimination that they caused and the problem they've caused us. Seems to me the argument's sort of incongruous and all. And it's hard for me to understand. I understand your explanation. I understand what I read in the brief. But again, why would not a responsible employer want to have punished through the legal system the person who caused the problem? Now, you're telling me a frivolous suit. Okay. If it's a frivolous suit, they could agree to defend the frivolous suit.
Maybe they won't, Your Honor. There's no requirement here that they do. And the statutory framework, Your Honor, let's look at the numerosity requirement and look at the intent here on whether an individual should be on the hook as opposed to the entity of the employer. The General Assembly made the choice of exposing to liability only people with 4 or more employees. Title VII, it's 15 or more employees. The analysis is that exemption for the small businesses, the mom and pop stores, as we've heard, is to not have civil liability run against the small shops. Well, the individual person, Your Honor, is the smallest legal entity there can be. If the General Assembly and the federal government intended to protect small business, why is there not an intent to protect the $20,000 a year assembly line worker with maybe a high school education, maybe not, who isn't well-versed in the discrimination laws of Ohio? Let the employer train that employee. Let the employer discipline that employee. Let the employer fire that employee if they're wrong. If that employee is wrongly sued or rightly sued, doesn't make any difference. The employer is the one that is on the hook for the anti-discrimination laws. Also, keep in mind that the remedies that were originally enacted by the General Assembly when the Ohio Civil Rights Act came to be didn't run against individuals. It was equitable remedies. It was administrative remedies through the Ohio Civil Rights Commission. It is inconceivable that the General Assembly had in its mind that individual guys in the assembly line would be sued by the words that they chose for the state.
Your argument is very reasonable. But how do we reach that point in face of the statute?
Well, the statute, you use the same analysis, Your Honor. I give you a couple of guideposts. You can use the same analysis as the Sixth Circuit did in the Waffen case. Another good guidepost is the Tennessee Supreme Court case, Carr versus UPS, where the Tennessee Civil Rights Act uses language very similar to the Ohio Civil Rights Act. The Tennessee definition of employer was any person acting as an agent of an employer directly or indirectly. So the Tennessee Act combines both the words of Ohio and the words of Title VII. The Tennessee Supreme Court's analysis was, this is not clear and unambiguous. It has two different possible interpretations. And they chose the interpretation that this means vicarious liability for the employer. So I suggest that if you think my argument is reasonable, that the Carr versus UPS case out of Tennessee in October 1997 is a good guidepost to see how another court, your sister courts, got to the same conclusion.
Ms. Sanderson.
I will answer your question, Your Honor. I don't want to take Mr. Hubbard's time unduly.
I want to ask you one more, and it's similar to Justice Resnick. Did Tennessee and did Waffen, are these courts construing what the General Assembly meant to say, as opposed to what it said? I mean, are we in that scenario here where they're trying to still get around the words? I mean, that...
Well, the analysis of Laughlin and Carver's UPS and the other cases, I think fairly look at both, Your Honor. They look at the actual language, and then, but they don't stop there. They also look at the intent, the policy, and they look at the consequences of holding one way or the other. And Laughlin and Carver and the other cases, they stick with responding at superior, make sure the employer's on the boat, and has every incentive to root out discrimination.
Thank you, Ms. Anderson. Mr. Hubbard.
Thank you, Your Honor. Police Court Justices of the Supreme Court. As Ms. Anderson has indicated, I represent two of the respondents of the matter before you. I would like to take just a few moments to address what I think is a very important issue that I would like you to consider, and that is the fact that overall ideals and goals of the 4112 Ohio Revised Code are best served by the present form of which is respondeat superior liability being imposed upon the employers. I think it's important, Your Honors, to take a look at the historical perspective that brought us 4112. As Mr. Goodes indicated, it was enacted in 1959, some 5 years after the United States Supreme Court decision in Brown versus Board of Education, and some 5 years prior to the enactment of Title VII by the U.S. Congress. I think it's important to note here, Your Honors, that this statute created a statutory cause of action for employment discrimination and discrimination with regard to personnel matters. This created a statutory cause of action that did not exist prior to 1959. It's important to note, Your Honors, that
Mr. Hubbard, may I interrupt you? Because I wonder if you're the person, Ms. Anderson didn't address the aid and abet section.
Yes,
and would you do that? All right, thank you.
The aid and abet language that is included in 4112 in subsection J, I suggest to you, Your Honors, is an inclusion in the enactment itself that has to do with third parties and third parties aiding and abetting any type of discrimination. This would be the type of situation where an employee, where a customer might be involved in some sort of discrimination. It's important to note, Your Honors, that an employer operates solely through his employees, and it cannot be said that an employer can aid and abet himself. Consequently, the language in subsection J, it seems to me, Your Honor, indicates clearly that is intended to involve itself with the notion that the third party is involved in some sort of discrimination and has very little, if anything, to do with the employees themselves. I might point out to you, ladies, Your Honors, that very notion was dealt with by the California Supreme Court just this past summer in July in the case of Reno versus Baird. And the California Supreme Court had a very in-depth discussion of that very notion, and they concluded the very same way, Your Honor, that the inclusion of the aiding and abetting language had to do with third parties and not the conduct of employees themselves. But it seems to me, Your Honor, that when we get back to the notion that we are concerned with the language of the statute as enacted, that the historical perspective is very important to consider. I believe that during that time frame, Your Honors, that it was important for the state legislature to make certain that employers would not be put in a position where they could disavow the actions of their employees and say that the employees were on a frolic of their own and in that way avoid the liability for the actions of their employees. And it's for that reason that they included the language of acting directly or indirectly on behalf of the employer. And I think that's very important to note, Your Honor. Yes?
I'm looking at 4112A, which liberal construction, this chapter shall be construed liberally for the accomplishment of its purpose.
seem to imply that the logic would indicate if the employee is also personally responsible, that enhances the anti-discrimination purposes of the statute, that the employer can then say in this education process, employees, look, if you screw up, we're on the hook, but so are you. So wouldn't this language about liberal construction indicate that we should come down the side of both employees responsible? And since your clock's running really fast, let me include the follow-up question. Does Anderson seem to indicate some concern over frivolous lawsuits? So is the bottom line with respect to look at this from the employer point of view, that if the employee is on the hook personally, that the employee may bring undue pressure there on the employer to settle a non-meritorious claim? Is that part of what's going on? So that's a two-part question.
If I understand correctly, I think it's important to look at all of this from a business perspective in response to your questions. It is our position that the employer is best able to monitor his employees, and it's not the courts to monitor the employees of the individual employers, that it is the employer who is best able to foster the ideals and the goals of 4112. Obviously, if an employee has done something that is discriminatory or harassing in nature, then that employer can discipline that employee by reprimand and by the ultimate discipline termination. So certainly it's the employer that is in the best position to monitor this. Could you remind me what the second
question? My question was twofold. Doesn't personal liability is that an enormous motivating factor not to discriminate individually? And if you're told we're liable, but so are you, and you can be sued and it can cost you a lot of money, isn't that a motivating force not to discriminate? But is the concern of employers that if the employee's on the hook, the employee, or in some cases the managers, maybe pressuring the employer on duly to settle a non-meritorious claim? Is that the concern?
Obviously, Your Honor, to impose upon the individual worker, as Ms. Anderson said, that the employee makes $20,000 a year or in that neighborhood, to impose upon them the duty of defending themselves in this sort of a situation is an onerous task. And that presumes, Your Honor, that each claim that is filed against a particular employee has merit. Obviously, all claims that are filed do not have merit. And obviously, if the employee is put in the position of having to defend, there's going to be that pressure from the employee to resolve matters, be they meritorious or not. And I think that puts all of the employer and the employee at odds in this particular case. And I'd suggest to you, Your Honor, that if we incorporate this language of individual liability with regards to employment decisions and the like, that we're putting our economic future in jeopardy. Not only because the individual employee would be putting his life savings on the line to defend himself on what may or may not be a meritorious claim, but it is also true that the employer would then be required to distance themselves from the employee to kind of indicate that the employee's actions are those of himself and to not ratify the activities of the employee. And I think it puts a very serious damper on the conduct of business as we know it. And I'm not certain that the legislature intended that result. Certainly, if they had intended that result, certainly they gave it the necessary thought to come up with a statutory scheme. It would have been a very simple matter for the members of the legislature to say that each employee would be individually liable for those acts. They chose not to that language, Your Honor. And I think they chose not to use that language for a purpose. And that is that they wanted the companies to have respondeat superior liability, and you cannot have respondeat superior liability and individual liability flowing from the same phrase.
Thank you, Mr. Hubbard.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Mr. Gittes, you've almost used your time. It'll take 30 seconds. Let me start you off with a question again about the statute. If the purpose of the General Assembly was to be sure that employees are liable, why do they need to use the words acting directly or indirectly in the interest of the employer? Why wouldn't they just say any person? Any person who is, I don't want to say employed or whatever, but why? Those words acting directly or indirectly in the interest of the employer sound like respondeat superior against a very persuasive argument that everybody ought to be responsible for their own conduct. I mean, that's a pretty good argument to me.
Your Honor, I think you have just touched on the heart of this debate. The responses are saying to you that if a statute creates respondeat superior liability, then it excludes personal liability. That's not the law. It never has been. Using the truck driving example. Yes, those words were used to make sure that the employer would be liable for the individual's conduct, but the statute is riddled by the definition of the terms to make it clear that individuals are also liable. That's why they include in the definition of person the words employees and individuals. Respondents are suggesting to you that an outsider who has nothing to do with the company can be liable as an agent or better, but the executives themselves are doing it aren't liable.
Well, but person is modified, though, and as you know, under two, employer is modified by these words acting directly or indirectly. I agree they've got all kinds of persons, occupations, sort of in the definition of person, but person in employer is, as you know, is modified by acting directly. Only those persons who are acting directly for the benefit of the employer are, as I see it, are persons liable. You're saying
the purpose of that provision was to do two things at the same time. One, to make it clear that individuals were liable for discriminatory promotion decisions, discriminatory firings, and to make it clear that the employer was liable for their acts. It was a dual purpose. Rather, if they didn't want individuals to be liable, it was easy for them to say it.
That's right.
We will not have individual liability.
They can make the same argument that they want individuals to be liable. They could say that, too.
But they did say it.
We're filling in the gaps there.
In a number of different ways, but certainly, this is a remedial statute. If there's any doubt at all, it should be in favor of expansive coverage. This statute will not affect all these assembly members. Look, we've had 20 years of lawsuits under federal law under Section 1981. I don't folks sue 20,000 a year workers. It's only when you have an executive or middle-level manager who's really going to afford some relief or an outrageous act. So outrageous the person should be personally culpable. And these people aren't burdened by it. They get a defense from the company in most of these cases. And if they're responsible and liable, they should answer for it. And if they're not, there's appropriate remedies under the law. Finally, I'm asking this court to remember two last things.
Very quickly.
Yes. This is an Ohio statute, not a federal statute. This is the first time you've been asked to interpret words that are peculiar to this statute and different from the federal law.
Counsel, on that line, give me a statement on
held in contempt. So the representations to this court that the remedies that existed in 1959 only could be ordered against an employer are simply untrue.
Thank you, Mr. Gittes. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. We'll take a brief recess.